Hi, I'm Amanda.
And I'm Rebecca, and this is Full Plate, Full Cup. We're startup leaders turned executive coaches who believe that you deserve to be wildly successful and wildly happy.
We interview trailblazing entrepreneurs, business leaders, and creatives so you can peek behind the curtain of how they got where they are today and start carving your own path towards success.
Each episode shares personal stories as well as actionable takeaways that you can apply to begin living a more joyful and fulfilling life.
Join us to learn how to scale your business, harness your power, and fill your cup.
If you like what you hear, subscribe, leave a review, and share with a friend. Thanks for listening. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Full Plate, Full Cup podcast. Today, we have an incredible guest. We know that she is going to have so much inspiring wisdom and knowledge to share, and she is a ton of fun. So, Lydia Finette, welcome to the Full Plate, Full Cup podcast. We're so excited to have you here.
Oh, Rebecca and Amanda, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
So I'm going to read an intro about you, Lydia, and then we are going to dive in because we have so much to ask you.
Oh, Lord.
Lydia Finette is the founder and CEO of the Lydia Finette Agency, a boutique agency representing best-in-class charity auctioneers. Over her two-decade-long career, Lydia served as the global managing director of strategic partnerships for Christie's and reshaped the fundraising landscape as the world's leading charity auctioneer. She has single-handedly raised over $1 billion for more than 800 organizations and broken down countless barriers for women in the auction industry and is widely recognized for her poise and power on stage, which I'm sure you'll all experience some of today. Lydia is the author of two best-selling books, The Most Powerful Woman in the Room Is You and Claim Your Confidence, as well as the podcast host of Claim Your Confidence in collaboration with Rockefeller Center. Lydia is represented by CAA and travels internationally to speak to companies about unlocking their sales potential, empowering people in the workplace, and the art of public speaking. Lydia, we are so on board for all of this, and we're delighted to talk to you about it. So, Lydia,
I hope that anyone's still awake after that bio.
You have a lot. There's a lot to your story. There's a lot to it. So you're known as a powerhouse auctioneer. I saw on Instagram yesterday, I think, that the Lydia Finette Agency has raised over, $43 million over the 7 months that you've been in operation. So congratulations. Those are powerhouse statistics if I've ever heard them.
Yeah, it's exciting.
It's incredible. And I know that you grew up in a small town in Louisiana. So we always like to throw it back a little bit to start off the podcast. What were little Lydia's hopes and dreams?
Little Lydia has been a dreamer since she was born. I have so many memories as a child of just waiting to be plucked out of a crowd as like a model, actress, star, always wanted to be famous from a very early age. All of those things, anyone who knew me as a child would say that those things were true. You know, I remember we lived in Lake Charles and we would go to Houston in Texas to the Galleria for shopping and for my birthdays and things like that. And I remember like walking through the Galleria because you'd always hear about children getting discovered, you know, like, oh, she was walking down the street. She was discovered. This was very like 17 magazine, you know. And I have been waiting to be discovered since I was a child. So that was little Lydia, very much on board with a big life. Always knew I wanted to live in a big city like New York and always wanted to do something that was going to kind of put me on the map.
Love that little Lydia was shameless about wanting to be a star, wanting to be discovered. And I love that you're claiming that for her, because I think so often we, especially as women, we kind of like downplay ourselves, downplay wanting to be discovered. And of course, little Lydia was walking through the mall like, here I am, sign me up.
Where's right? Mr. Barbizon?
Little Lydia's a little bit like big Lydia, if I think about it. She's not really much changed. I think it's always kind of been there. The road to get any kind of recognition in life, as you both know, is long, meandering, and bumpy at best. But certainly in those early years, I was laser focused on, you know, star search, trying all the things that could make me, you know, get some kind of notoriety from a very early age. So I don't know where that comes from. It's funny when I think back to that. I don't know if it was something that I saw, but, you know, having a big life, the idea of something bigger than what most people would experience was always very appealing to me. There was nothing in me that ever thought I would be in Louisiana for the rest of my life, you know, kind of going out on the boat on Sundays the way that I had as a child, but not that I would change my upbringing at all because it was such a wonderful way to grow up. But I knew that when I grew up, which is something that I wanted to do probably from the age of four, I always wanted to be a grown up. I knew that's what I wanted. And I see it in my oldest daughter who actually lives in New York. And I see her always being like, well, when I'm grown up, she's 11. And I just look at her and I'm like, no, I wish I would say to her, you should just enjoy being a child. But I know what she's saying because that's how I felt too. Like I just wanted to be grown up and experience all the things from a very early age.
From reading your books, it sounds like you had incredible parents. No, parents are perfect, but it sounds like yours were pretty damn close. So one thing that they taught you was to never give up. How do you know, or how can anyone know when you are just running into a wall, trying to get that thing, trying to be discovered, trying to live a big life versus when it's time to pivot and change directions?
Yeah, I mean, experience plays a huge role in that. And one thing I would say about confidence is the more things you try, the more you get rejected, the more you overcome these things, the more confident you become. So you can't live in a box and think that you're going to be confident in your skills, because if you're living in a box, you know exactly what to do within those four walls. So the key to this, the key to the big life, the key to success, in my opinion, is trying tons of things and understanding if they don't work. A, there's probably a learning that you're learning from it regardless, sometimes not, but for the most part, there's probably something you're learning. And B, the other part of that is if it doesn't work, it's okay. Sometimes there's a round peg square hole scenario that you need to think of another way to make it happen. And so when I say never give up, it's like, don't just run yourself into a wall. Like this isn't working, but what are you learning from this? What can you change to make it possibly work? And when do you just let it go? Because sometimes things aren't going to work and that's okay too. But don't stop trying and don't stop moving forward is what never give up means to me.
Yeah. Now, speaking of never giving up, you started your career at Christie's, and in your books, you talk about like you were able to forge a path by saying yes, yes to every opportunity, just, you know, raising your hand. But auctioneering is typically a very, you know, or has been in the past, a very male-driven industry. So, you know, imposter syndrome, even though you knew you wanted to be a star, you had that star quality inside you. How did you deal with imposter syndrome, being both a young person and also a female in an industry where, from my own knowledge, it's usually like old guys?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, imposter syndrome was such a huge part of my career for so long because not only did I see something different ahead of me as the penultimate, you know, there were no women up on the rostrum that I was thinking, oh, that's who I want to be. It was always these sort of elder statesmen in tuxedos doing the thing. And so I think that was one part of it. But there was also the very real things that were being said to me when I became an auctioneer. You know, when I would go out to take my auctions when I was 24, you know, I was a baby auctioneer. And it's funny that I would even use that language because there were a lot of guys my age who were training and were passing the class and they did not refer to themselves as baby auctioneers. It was very much like, oh, Lydia's the young girl. Like she's the young lady who's going on stage, the lady auctioneer. And so as a result of that, from hearing that, I started to adopt that language. I mean, I just used it. I've been an auctioneer for 22 years and I just used that about myself, guys. That should tell you something. I wasn't the norm. I wasn't what people were expecting. So there was always the sort of surprise and not necessarily the delight at meeting me as the auctioneer the first time. Like I would walk in the room and people would say, right, oh, you're so young, or, oh, you're a woman. And, you know, Lydia to me is not a guy's name. Maybe I'm wrong, but, you know, I would have expected that. I think that they just never in a million years thought that a woman would be walking in the room to take the auction. And then those were the first two responses. And then it was sort of like, where's the auctioneer? I'm like, I'm the auctioneer. No, the person who's on stage taking the auction, not the person who's standing next to the auctioneer or like in the crowd. No, I'm like, no, I'm still the auctioneer. Like the answer will always lead to me. So, you know, let's accept it and move on. And then it was kind of like, well, you're going to sit at the kids' table, or, oh, we'll put, you don't need a seat, do you, Lydia? And I let that happen as well, because I would agree with everything they said, because of course, in the South, it's always about being agreeable. And the way I was taught in life was to be polite and do what people said and nod my head and say, thank you so much. And all of those things feed right into the imposter syndrome. right? Mm-hmm. If people are telling me I'm young and I'm a girl and I'm going to sit in the back table and I'm agreeing and saying, thank you so much. And thank you for the opportunity for letting me be here to donate my time to your organization. Like, it's just this people pleasing circle that just keeps going and going and going. And it wasn't until almost a decade into taking auctions. And I say to people all the time, a decade of me taking auctions is 700 auctions. You know, I was on stage 70 nights a year. You know, if you think some people go to one gala a year, I go to 70 still to this day, 70, 70 different cocktail dresses, 70 different things to auction off. And in each of those things, I'm learning through this process, and yet I'm still allowing that language and I'm still embracing that imposter syndrome. And so about a decade into my career, I talk in the book about this moment where I had this aha moment on stage where I really showed up and started taking an auction as a young woman, as opposed to the older statesman that I adopted as my personality, and how the crowd reacted in such a different way. And how, for me, that was such a formative moment because I looked in the audience and thought, wait a second, there's another way to do this. And what if I showed up as myself? And so then the next decade of my career was peeling back that imposter syndrome and making it disappear. And I say in one of my books, I can remember getting off stage so many times. Being a charity auctioneer takes a really tough skin because a lot of times things don't go well. Like the crowd is
and
wild.
And you're on stage.
And you're on stage. No one's paying attention to you. You just have to push through the muck and get off the stage. And so I remember there's a comment even to this day, I'll get off when I get off stage. Someone will grab my hand and say, "Ooh, that was a tough crowd." And that sentence used to send me into a spiral of like, oh my God, I can't control the crowd. I'm not good at this. I don't know what I'm doing, blah, blah, blah. You know, and I'd go home and I'd cry and I'd be like, never going to get on stage. And now, I mean, they'll put their hand, I'll put my hand over to be like, I'm a charity auctioneer. There is no other type of crowd. Mm. They're all tough crowds. Like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't affect me anymore. And I think that that happened for me really sort of in the second decade of being a charity auctioneer, which is a lot. It's a long time, guys. A lot of getting in, a lot of getting out.
Yeah. And I'm so glad that you shared that, because I think for a lot of people listening, hell, even for me, you know, I think like the first, I always talk about the first 12 years of my career was like practice almost, despite having accomplished a decent amount, you know, and for people listening, you know, I think it offers a large degree of comfort to know that mastery, you know, does not, you know, sometimes success happens overnight, but mastery never happens overnight, right? Mastery happens over decades. And so I appreciate you sharing that. You know, our business is called Full Plate, Full Cup. Our show is called Full Plate, Full Cup. And so, you know, we talk a lot about having a full plate, right? Lots going on, busy calendar, and at the same time, keeping your cup full, right? Whether that is physical health, emotional health, self-care, play, fun, sleep, whatever. You've got a busy calendar, right? 70 nights on stage a year. How do you know when to say no to something? How do you know to dial it back? And how do you keep your cup full when there's so many things you are doing?
Yeah. So, you know, I think part of overcoming imposter syndrome too is understanding when you are at the top of your game that you have to start scaling your business and raising your rates. So a lot of it for me, I mean, I'll tell you, for the first 11 years that I took auctions, so 700-800 auctions, I never charged anyone. Christie's asked us to donate our time, even though we weren't compensated by the company. And the better I got, the more auctions I was asked to take. It always, as I said, felt for me like it was a privilege to be on that stage. And so I just kept saying thank you and accepting the responsibility to go on stage. I had a full-time job at Christie's. Being an auctioneer is a volunteer position. And so I was doing 70 to 80 auctions on top of a full-time job, which my first decade was running the events team for North and South America. And my second decade was running a global team for strategic partnerships. So I had a really big job at work and then really big expectations at night. And in my early 30s, I was about to have my first child. And my husband was like, what in holy hell is going on here? It's like, you are pregnant. You are like seriously sick with morning sickness. You're on stage every night. What are you doing? And I was like, but I can't charge anyone. And he's like, why? Like, he's like, Lydia, no man would ever do this. Like, what are you doing? And so I remember the first organization calling them and saying, listen, I know you guys want me to do this and I want to be there, but And I used my husband. I was like, my husband and I were talking about it. And I really think I should get paid for this. And, you know, they all expected me to do it for free. And they were like, well, what do you think? And I was like, well, what, maybe like $500? And I mean, it was like, I think the man like laughed. He was like, yeah, that's fine. Like, we'll pay you $500. You know, you're the only person who makes money here. Like, we pay the florists and the flowers come and then they die. Like, and it was just such like a no brainer for him. And I was like, oh my God, I'm such an idiot. Like, I'm such an idiot. And then, you know, I have such great guy friends who are such great sounding boards for me in business and always have been. And I've been the person who listens ever since I was young, because I didn't grow up in a house where we talked about money. And so it's been educating myself either through friendships, through, you know, my husband's friends, honestly, some of my really good girlfriends who've done well in business. The past like 15 years of me becoming a businesswoman and an entrepreneur have really been about listening to the things that have been said to me. And again, like 5 or 6 years in, I'm charging a little like more and more each year. But I said, one of the guys was like, so how much? He's like, they love this business. They've always loved my auction business. They're like, so how many auctions are you taking? I'm like, guys, it's crazy. I'm like on stage 80 years. I had 100 requests. He's like, you got to raise your rates. And I was like, what? And he's like, you have to raise your rates. Like, you can't want to be on stage 100 nights a year. And I was like, oh, that's a really good point. I never really thought of that. And so then I started raising my rates. And then, you know, it's gotten to the point now where I couldn't in a million years keep up with the number of requests that come in. I take 70 auctions a year and I've capped there. My rates are consistent across the board. I still donate my time to 10 organizations over the course of the year. That's like the core of my business. And it's a lot of money that I'm giving away as a result of that. And I know that, but that to me feels right. And then the other 60 I charge for. And there are rates for New York City, tri-state, getting on a plane, going international, period, end of sentence. First come, first serve. I do not negotiate. I am totally fine with people saying they can't. But that's the reason I started my agency, because there are organizations out there that cannot afford me to be on their stage, and I don't want them to write that check. Like, if they give me their fundraising angle, I'm like, you should not pay for me to be on your stage. However, I have 10 auctioneers who I've trained. A lot of them are junior auctioneers. They're coming up. Some are in medium. Some have unbelievable amounts of experience. There's someone thing. So there is something for everyone. And so that really for me has been the evolution of my agency. And so that's allowed me to fill up my cup more, because I've held those rates. I've scaled that business. It's locked, loaded, and that feels right to me. I'm also an extrovert, so I don't really get tired, and I don't get tired of being around people, which sounds crazy because people are always like, you must be so tired after all these things. I'm like, no, I actually get energy. I don't like being by myself. I like being with other people. And then I'm a huge exerciser. So, you know, I had a car accident 2 years ago. I have a titanium rod in my spine. It's more important than ever that I move and that I'm consistently moving. Otherwise, it starts to kind of hurt, especially after long plane trips or sitting for long periods of time. And so, you know, just the constant exercise for my body is important. And then finally, just spending time with my family, which is the best part of it all. You know, it's just being able to recharge with all of my kids piled on top of me on the couch watching a movie. That's a pretty amazing feeling, until they start fighting and then I'm like, get off. But the first part of it is amazing.
People listening to the audio, you can't see, but we're like clapping, snapping, nodding. We're like, yes, this whole thing. We're like, yes.
Did you think I would answer the question?
You answered it perfect. I wanted to hear every one of those words. So thank you.
I always halfway through, I'm like, am I even answering the question anymore? And then I have to remember what the question is and make it full circle. So there you go.
No, what I want to point out about what you just said, though, is that not everyone can afford you. And that's okay. That doesn't mean that you lower your rates. That doesn't mean that you're always making exceptions. Like, it's okay for not everyone to be able to afford you, right? And with your agency now, you're able to offer them other options, which is fantastic. But even before you had your agency, it's okay to turn down opportunities if it's not the right match for one reason or another. And one of those reasons might be financial reasons.
And also, guys, what did I say at the beginning of this? Like, shedding off those layers of imposter syndrome is realizing that you are the best at what you do and you can charge your rate. And what I think to myself all the time is, I charge those rates, and the nights that I'm not on stage, I'm home with my kids. And so if you can't afford that rate, that is fine. Then that Tuesday night for me is home on the couch with my kids, doing the homework, doing the things, not zipping up my dress at 8 o'clock at night and running out of the door, which I love that equally. I love that time on stage. I love raising money, but it's also okay. And by making that choice, it allows me to spend more time with my kids. And so I think remembering too what you're doing and what you're doing things for in your own life is really important.
Absolutely. You know, staying on the finance track, something that I really enjoyed reading about in your books is your relationship to money and how open you are about finances. And oh my God, I wish more women talked about money. And Amanda, I think you're on the same page as me. You know, I grew up in a family where we were talking about money all the time. And
that's great.
I know that that's not the case with a lot of women that I know. So why is being aware of your finances, of your financial situation, if you are with a partner, of your partnered financial situation, why is that so important in owning your confidence?
Listen, I said at the beginning, we never talked about money when I was little. I mean, I knew about money, but my parents were sort of like, there was money. We would do the things that we did. There was never an explanation as to why we did what we did. I didn't have a credit card. I didn't really understand what a checking account was. I mean, don't even get me started about savings or any of those things. My parents knew what they were doing, or my father knew. I feel like my mom didn't really know. And as I've gotten older and I've seen so many of my friends, especially I'm in my 40s now, and I've seen the past two decades, some of my friends, especially during COVID, especially during the recession, like all of a sudden, husband has massive job, husband loses massive job. Turns out that there's not as much money as they thought. And there's just this like, oh, I had no idea. And to me, that's the scariest thing in the world, to have no idea what financial situation you're in. Because at the end of the day, if you don't have money, you can't do the things you want to do, right? Money gives you options. It gives you security. It gives you the ability to navigate your own life. And so if you don't know how much money you have, either as a single person or someone who is married, who allows their partner to do everything, there's just so many things that can go wrong. Financial security is the core to it all. It's the key to it all. If you know what you have and you know what's going out each month and you know what you're saving, like, you're in control of your destiny. If one of those things is not there, you need to really spend some time digging in. Like, I mean, I've used like the most basic people. I mean, Suze Orman, I still don't know how to say her name. She is the reason that I opened a 401k at Christie's and started matching my dollars one-to-one. I used to do 1% of my salary because I made like $12 a year. 1% of my salary when I was 21 years old, or 22, I think is when I started. And then when I started making a little more money there, I would put more in there and it would just disappear every month. I'm in my 40s now and I have seen that money, which eventually I maxed out at the company match. And like she would say, if you're not matching, or you're not taking advantage of a company match, you are literally throwing money out of the window. I think I heard her say it 9 times before I finally did it. But I've seen that money grow over the past 20 years. I mean, what if I had started when I was 14 or 10 or 9, you know? And I think things like that, just educating children about money, explaining what they can do with that money is so important. And also the choices we make with our money. I gave this example actually on a podcast yesterday. My husband works with me and we were going through the expenses last year, just getting ready for taxes and everything like that. And I was looking at my subway usage because I live in New York, and I take the subway everywhere, literally everywhere. People are like, oh, and then, you know, if you need a car to the auction, I'm like, I don't. I'll throw my shoes in a bag and get on the subway. I'll take the subway anywhere. It's more efficient. I don't get car sick. I love it. I mean, it's kind of gross, but I love it. But my point in saying that is when we were looking at the expenses, it showed that I'd taken the subway 40 times in the month of October. Like, let's just ballpark it there, 40 times. And I pulled my son over and my daughter, who the night before had been like, we want to take an Uber home. New York City's Ubers are in a class by themselves. Like, you can easily get in an Uber and spend $70 going uptown. I live all the way downtown in Tribeca. Like, we're not in the middle of the island. And I said to her, I was like, I just want to tell you something. I was like, subway ride, let's call it $3. I was like, I've spent $120 on subways this month. I was like, think about if I had spent $50 on an Uber every single time instead of that. You know, and she's thinking in her head. I'm like, we're spending like $1,500 to $2,000 in Ubers. And I was like, think about what we could do with that money if we didn't spend it on Ubers every single month. And, you know, in her mind, she's like, okay, so 2,000 times 12, so that's $24,000. I'm like, I'm not even going to get into taxes right now, but like, just think about that. And I was like, that is so many trips and so many trips to Sephora. I mean, really, to bring it down to an 11-year-old, think of the drunken elephant.
How many lip glosses? Yeah.
How many lip balms, you know, in her little mind. How many Taylor Swift tickets could we buy?
Oh,
totally. God. Because we chose to walk as opposed to getting in an Uber. And that's not to say every once in a while it's snowing or it's raining and we want to use it, fine, but not every day. There's no reason, because it's not that we can't do it. It's that we choose to use our money differently. And just little lessons like that are just so important for all of us. Like, even someone in their 20s is probably listening to this right now and being like, oh, maybe you're right. Like,
oh, that's me with the Ubers.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, totally. Yeah.
Amanda knows it too. Amanda knows I avoid the subway at all costs.
Oh, Rebecca, you got to go to the subway. I know. No, I had a babysitter who came and had babysat for us for a couple of hours and then was leaving and was getting an Uber. And I said to my husband, I was like, I think she just spent everything we gave her to babysit to get home. Like, what on earth? It's 8:30 at night. She lives like 20 blocks away. I'm like, first of all, I would walk that in 2 seconds. But the thought that like you would spend that, I mean, what a waste, just burning cash. So anyway, Rebecca, if nothing else on this podcast, I hope that I will get you on the subway at least half the time. It doesn't have to be full time.
I feel so called out right now, but also for a good cause. And my husband will thank you for this.
You're welcome, Rebecca's husband. I don't know you, but you're welcome.
So Lydia, something that we talk about often is how you will have to sacrifice for success, but you don't necessarily need to suffer for your success, right? There's that difference between sacrifice and suffering. You are the first to admit that like you have missed out on a lot going on stages 70 nights a year, whether that's time with your kids, nights out with friends, time with your husband. How do you delineate between suffering and success in your own career?
Listen, there have definitely been moments where I'm like, oh God, I know I have to do this. And it just kills me. You know, there was an example that any working mom will really probably feel when I say this, but I had been contracted to take an auction in Atlanta last year for this big, I work with a car company for this big Porsche 75th anniversary sale. They were super excited about it. Contract signed, ready to go. And I found out that my daughter, who was playing the lead in Grease, was opening night of a one night show. And I mean, when I tell you, like, I am a theater person, my daughter is such a theater kid. Like, this is our joint love. We walk with an earbud each around New York City, listening to musicals together. I take her to Broadway. Like, this is our shared love. She worked to get that part. I ran the lines with her. I mean, I couldn't even tell her. I started crying when I found out. I saw the date come out and I was like, June 9th. Like, I can still remember it. And it was awful. It was absolutely awful. I told her, she started crying. I think I started crying harder, which I think made her feel better, to be honest. She's like, oh, you're sad. You're going to miss it. Things like that are really painful, really painful. But, you know, I like to think that there's always a way to make something memorable if I can't be there. In her case, she had wanted her ears pierced. She had been asking to get her ears pierced. I told her 12. I just threw that out when she was like 4. I don't know why it stuck. And she was 10 at the time. And so I called the woman who ran Spotlight Kids. And I was like, listen, is there any wiggle room on the stage? She's like, there's not. But what if you came to dress rehearsal the week before? And so I went with my daughter right before we were sort of going downtown to go to dress rehearsal. I put a little thing in her. I gave her a little envelope and she opened it up and I said, I won't be there with you, but let's get your ears pierced. So at least there's something with you that will make you know that I'm with you. So we went and got her ears pierced. And then I went to the dress rehearsal. And then she felt like, to this day, she'll remember that whole sequence. She knows that I wasn't there. I watched it on FaceTime. I got off the podium right like 5 minutes before. I was like running through the pits. I'm like, oh my God, everybody's going to make it. I got off 5 minutes before. So I watched it on FaceTime. So I saw it, but I was not physically there, you know? But that's kind of like what I try to do whenever there's a moment that feels like I'm missing something that I desperately want to be at or something like that. I try to make something that makes it feel as good as possible. But I also say, like, I always make the effort. You know, my friends will say, and have said since I was 24, I always miss dinner during season. Like, you can never have dinner with me in April or May. I never have dinner with me in October or November, but I'll come for a glass of water before dessert at the end. So like, I can't make it for dinner, but I'll be there before, I'll be there after. And so I do make that effort. I'll get off stage and go to a restaurant and like, I'll have some cold food and some dessert, you know, maybe half a glass of wine.
Yeah. What's so important about what you just said, but also what you said previously is, you know, part of charging your worth is so that you don't have those regrets necessarily, right? Yeah. Like if you're always, and this is true, when you say yes to a crappy client that's not paying you enough, and then you have to say no to a great client, right? Whether it's personal or professional sacrifices, by really knowing, hey, this is what my time is worth, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, nothing's worth missing your daughter's show, right? Like it doesn't necessarily equate, but it allows you to not have those pangs of regret as often. Yeah. There's so many entrepreneurs that I know or that I work with that are constantly saying yes to things and then regretting it later.
Yeah.
So one of the things that you say is you are what you negotiate. So let's talk about negotiating tips. Like, how do you make sure that you're getting what you deserve and something that feels equitable? So you're excited to work on a project or take an event or whatever versus like, oh, they really got one over on me this time.
Yeah. I mean, I think as an entrepreneur, one thing I found that really works for me is that I try to lead with like, if it's nervous fear and I'm excited, I do it. And if it makes me feel like a horse being pulled, I don't do it. Because there are things that I will, this is having worked in a corporate environment for 24 years, there are things you have to do in your job. And I definitely knew that there were things that I didn't like doing. And those things slow me down and make me tired and make me not want to do everything else. What I found as an entrepreneur is if I stay towards the things that I'm passionate about, I'll be up at 5 o'clock in the morning, no problem, getting things ready. You know, I have a podcast that I love so much. And, you know, I have 5 interviews this week and I'm back to back all the time with the things that I'm doing over the course of the day. So like, that's an early morning start for me, doing the research, getting things ready for the podcast. That's okay. I don't mind it. But that's definitely part of it. And if you don't start making decisions based like that as an entrepreneur, a lot of times you'll find yourself doing things just because you think you're supposed to be doing them. And then it takes away from everything because it takes you longer because you don't want to do it. So yes, scaling your business, making sure that you're charging adequately is an incredibly important part of it, but also having enough confidence to believe that by dismissing the things that are not going to serve you, you're actually making a better choice for yourself is another part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, speaking of confidence, you've written 2 books, one of which is called Claim Your Confidence. And you know, what I'm curious about hearing about your schedule, right? Hearing about all the things you have going on and what a devoted mom you are. How did you carve out the time to insert those 2 very big projects into your life? What did that look like in terms of prioritization, deprioritization? Like how, because I think, you know, whether or not someone has an aspiration to write a book, perhaps there's a big project that lands on their lap and they're like, ooh, I really want to do this, but gosh, how do I carve out that extra time that I'm going to need to do this and do this well?
Yeah, I'm a big believer in micro steps. It's all mental, in my opinion. You know, I wrote my book based on a proposal that I had submitted to, well, I told the New York Times I was writing a book before I was writing a book. I had written 1 chapter of a book and sent it to my best friend's agent right when the New York Times piece came out and then sold the whole book in the next week. So I had literally 1 chapter written and it like a kind of a rough outline that I'd thrown together because I knew that this piece was coming out and I told them I was writing a book. So I was like, oh, I really need to do this. And, but then I had to write the book and they gave me, so we signed mid-December of 2017 and they gave me until April 1st. And so I had like a full panic attack because I didn't know, you guys, I did not know anything about writing a book. I've been a reader since I was born in my dreaming stage. Like that's probably why I was such a big dreamer because I would read like 9 books a night because I also don't sleep. And so I literally was like, oh my God, what have I done? Like signed a contract. This book is due in 4 months, like 3.5 months at this point. And I realized that what I needed to do after the initial panic had set in, that they basically said that I had to write 70,000 words. Which is a lot of words, by the way. If you don't know that, it's a lot of words, like 270 pages. But if you think about that number, it just sounds really overwhelming. And with my one chapter in the proposal, I had about 10,000 words. So I was like, okay, it's 60,000 words. So I decided what I was going to do, because I basically had 60 days, was I was going to write 1,000 words a day. When you talk about carving out time for things, you have to think about something that's actually doable. Because at first I was like, I'll write a chapter a week. And then I'm like, what does that mean? Panic, panic, panic. And then I was like, I'll write 1,000 words a day. It's about an hour of writing. At the time, I had my full-time job at Christie's. I had my night job. My third child was not even a year old because she turned a year at the end of March. And I was still nursing her. I would get up at 5 because she was getting up in the 6s at that point. I'd get up at 5 and I would start the writing for the day. So I didn't say 1,000 words in one sitting. I said 1,000 words, right? So I would start writing in the morning and I would write literally on the subway on my phone. I would write while I was writing. I was like walking with my phone. If I was backstage at an auction, I wouldn't sit for dinner. I would write backstage on my phone, send everything to myself. And at night, I would get it to 1,000 words, whatever that looked like. If I was on a tear and writing a lot, it was 1,500 words. I only had to write 500 the next day. So it was, but it was 1,000 words come hell or high water every single day. And I carved out that time. And it was so stressful, you guys. Like I honestly sometimes think about that. I'm like, how did I do that? But I also think about that time and I'm like, if you want to make anything happen, you can make it happen. It doesn't matter how many balls you have in the air, putting one more in and just moving it forward is always doable if you're willing to put in the time.
Yeah. And it wasn't writing 1,000 words in one sitting, right? I think often when you think of tackling a big project, you think you have to like get up and do your ritual and like set the stage and then it's time to do the thing, right? But you were writing in little pockets of time that you were able to find throughout your day whenever they occurred. And, you know, what I want to point out to people is that it's an imperfect on the surface, perfect approach, right? Yeah. It's not necessarily sexy. It's not necessarily like the most, I'm sure, the most joyful thing every minute you whip out your phone and write down some words, but it gets you to where you want to go, to this incredible payoff and this incredible dream that you had. So, you know, Lydia, when I heard you speak at the Women's Power Lunch last year, something that you did that was so generous and really shocked me is that you offered openly to share your book proposal with anyone who was in the audience who asked. Yeah. And I think everyone kind of sat back in their seat and gasped a little bit like, is this bitch serious? It was wild. And I believe a few people actually asked you afterwards and you did share your proposal from, because I followed up with people. I was like, did she really share her proposal with you? And yes, you did. So can you talk about, because you're a big advocate of supporting each other versus viewing each other as competition, no matter how crowded the stage is. So why is that important? And how can we get over this competition mindset, especially as women, and especially when we're pursuing a dream in a crowded field?
Yeah, I just think that people often think that, you know, there's only one spot. Like there are as many spots as you make. It doesn't matter. And so me writing a book is not going to be the same book that someone else writes. And when I offer to do my proposal, I mean, I say there's always such an interesting pair of things that happens. First of all, I make that offer. And even though out of that room of a couple hundred people, how many people actually followed up? Like 2, 3, 4, right? And then out of those 4, has anyone written a book? Has anyone tried for a proposal? Like, I don't even remember, but I would suspect possibly one. And that's the interesting thing, because you can give people, and I say this endlessly, like I can give people every tool in my arsenal, but they've got to do the work. And so you have to have someone who's willing to do the work. Otherwise it doesn't happen. You know, I talk a lot about exercise. You know, I remember someone saying to me, like, you just always find time to exercise, Lydia. Like you just always find time to exercise. I'm like, yeah, you're right. I do. I never go anywhere without my running shoes. I've never been on a single trip in my life without my running shoes, because even if it's 10 minutes and I can run around the outside of the hotel and run back in, I'll do it, you know? And so you have to be disciplined. You have to be motivated yourself in order to make those things happen. And if you are going to be a motivated individual and take my book proposal and write a killer book and get on the New York Times bestseller, you better believe I'm cheering you on, because I know what it takes. And I would do that for any of my friends. And so that's just the way I view life. I don't think about you succeeding, me not succeeding. I think about us succeeding and me being like, you are amazing and I love you and I love cheering you on. And I've been the recipient of that kind of friendship with a lot of my friends, and I've realized how unthreatening and how wonderful it is. And so the more people I can say, like, do it, go do it, the better I feel about the way that I'm impacting people in life. And you know, I love the phrase and I use it all the time. Like, there's so many like coulda, shoulda, wouldas out there. You know, I could have done that. I should have done that. I'm like, you can, you should, you will, if you want.
Yeah.
But that's the difference, right? You have to want to do it.
Yeah. I mean, that is, I love that mentality. I wish more people had it. I'm glad for everyone listening. Maybe it will inspire them to kind of un-gatekeep a little bit. Yeah. And speaking of coulda, shoulda, and did, you launched your own agency.
Yes.
And it's raised over $43 million, as we mentioned, in just seven months. So how did you know it was time to put your name on the marquee, so to speak? What kind of prompted that move?
Well, we had a car accident. I always say that that was kind of a huge impetus in my life. And I had spoken to Christie's about being an ambassador for the company the summer before that. And, you know, things at Christie's, I'd been there for almost 24 years at that point, 23, 24 years. And, you know, I was kind of coming to a close of my career there. And Christie's, I think on their side, was kind of in a similar spot. And it's weird to be in that spot because it's almost like you don't really know what to do. Like, it's almost like your family. You're like, what do we do? And so I'd sort of floated the idea of an ambassadorship that the summer before the accident. And the answer had kind of been like, we're not interested in that. And then after the accident, the partnerships division, which I was running, my boss had left during the accident and he wasn't there. I'd been gone for 3 months and they were kind of like, we're not even sure that we want to continue this. What would you think about the ambassadorship? And, you know, it seemed like the perfect way for me to figure out my next step in such a gracious and lovely way. And I had a long non-compete as well. So, you know, I immediately went and met with the CEO of Sotheby's, like probably a week after. And I just had kind of lost enthusiasm for working at an auction house in general. Like, I remember he's the nicest man. And I remember sitting in his office just thinking, like, we were talking and I was like, I feel like I'm selling something I don't even want to sell. Mm. You know? It's like, well, what do you want? And I was like, in my mind, I'm like, I don't even know. Like, I don't even know what I want. I just need time and space. And I think I'd already been through so much in the months leading up to that. It was just like, there was just so much and so many emotions. And so having the opportunity to not be in an office and only take auctions, which is essentially what my ambassadorship was, continue growing the business that I had already started with my side business as an auctioneer, and understanding that ultimately, even during that year as an ambassadorship, people were like, oh, we didn't even really work. We didn't realize you still worked with Christie's. Like, we don't care. And I had been holding on to it. Like, I could never not work there. And people were like, oh, I thought you left Christie's like 7 years ago. I'm like, what? They're like, yeah, no, I thought you left when your first book came out. Like, no, I've been there the whole time. What? So there were just so many conversations. And then some that were basically like, listen, if you didn't work there, it would be great because then you could come and do things, even if Sotheby's is sponsoring things. And I realized like the skills that I created and spent time honing on those stages late at night had usurped my role at Christie's and had become their own thing. And I, as a brand, as my own brand, which I had started to build with the books and then the podcast, that had taken on a life of its own. And, you know, the auction for me is, as I've spoken about before, you know, there are very few people who have the experience that I have, the network that I have, and been on the stages that I've been on. And that in itself is such an incredible premium that I realized that it was time for me to leave Christie's and start something on my own. And so when my ambassadorship came up at the end of the first year, I just like couldn't bring myself to sign it. It sat in my inbox for a while. And it wasn't until I fully fleshed out the idea of this agency that I realized like that was going to be the next step. And then once I thought of it, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And that's when you know. And so that was kind of the end of it. I didn't sign up. I sent like a, you know, just a nice note thanking everyone at Christie's for all those years. And the next day I launched the agency and it felt amazing. Like the perfect thing. And not really even that scary, actually. It just felt like,
yeah,
this is what's supposed to happen.
Yeah. What I want to point out about what you said, a couple of things. One is you mentioned like the time and space was really necessary and yes. for you to really know what you wanted to do next. And I think that's really important for people to hear, especially people who resonate with your go, go, go sort of energy and attitude, right? Like for those of us that are wired that way, time and space can be scary. Time and space can be, you know, the danger zone. But that is where, you know, people always say, where'd the idea come from? Oh, it came out of nowhere. Well, you need that nowhere. You need that kind of empty space for those ideas. For those to come up.
I can remember at the end of my time at Christie's when my phone shut off, like my account of 23 at that point years shut off. And I went to my ambassador email, which was still Christie's, but a different Christie's email. And like the first week, it was my children's spring break and we were down in Louisiana with my parents. And I remember I kept picking up my phone because I had two phones, actually. I was so used to having two phones and juggling all this stuff. And there were no emails. And it was like, I almost didn't know what to do. Like even when I was after the car accident in the hospital, I was answering emails. I'm like, there were just no emails. Like no one had my Gmail account because I'd had a Christie's account since I was 19. You know, it was like this crazy thing. And so I remember saying to myself so many times over the ensuing months, like, be present, just be here, like stop reaching for your phone. And then I remember even like a couple of weeks or months actually later being with one of my best friends, Marriott, and she kept picking up her phone at lunch. And I just remember thinking, like, God, this is so funny that it feels so peaceful to not even care because there's nothing else. It's only what's in here. And so I feel like it took me probably like a good 5 or 6 months. And then I remember coming back to the city in September of that year after the summer. And it was almost like I went into like seventh gear. It was like I'd skipped 1 through 5 and all that time and all that energy and all that space just had a full direction and I knew exactly what was going to happen. And it was just like, I don't think I stopped since. I felt like I was shot out of a cannon.
Well, you've done so much and I imagine that there's an equal amount that you still want to do. So what
is so many things
for you, Lydia? Let's speak it into the world.
All right. Do you guys want to hear this? This is the year of finding fun and failure. So I'm going to tell you this before I tell my agent. Okay. So my next idea, I'm writing my third book that I've been doing, which is sort of the next from my most powerful woman in the room is you to claim your confidence to this next book, which would be kind of like the evolution of leaving Christie's and creating your side hustle and turning it into a full-time scalable business. So that's one. I had started writing a book when I was at Christie's, kind of a fiction book. And I had a podcast with Ellen Hildebrand, the Queen of Beach Reads. She's written 30 books. And she said to me, she's like, I can't believe you've never written a book about the auction world. And I was like, I actually have. I wrote like, you know, 2/3 of a chick lit book in 2007, when I was like at my desk, just with extra time running events, like 3 hours every night, just with nothing to do while people ate dinner. And she's like, oh, you got to get that book back out, which is something that my mother has been saying. She's like, Lydia, you got to start writing fiction because you have such a vivid imagination. Like God only knows what you'd write. So, and then after at the end of Ellen's interview, she said to me that she and her daughter were writing a book. And I was telling my kids that my kids are like, we want to write a book. So my idea is to pitch a fiction book, a nonfiction book, and a children's book called The Most Confident Kid in the Room is You. So I'm manifesting all three of those things and I could write them simultaneously because once I start writing, I don't stop. But that's my idea. So we'll see. And then maybe none of those things will happen. Maybe two, maybe nothing will happen. My agent is going to kill me for saying this. Here you go, Meg Thompson.
Hopefully you get to Meg before this episode comes out.
Who cares? It doesn't matter. It's all fun.
Meg, if you don't know, now you know. And Lydia, if you write that children's book, Amanda and I will be first in line to buy it for our daughters. No joke.
Oh, I love it. And you guys too. I said the most confident kid in the room is you because my son, I feel like, is living in a world of just lady power in every direction. And I want him to be part of it too. And I do think kids, boys and girls, need confidence. And we all get it in our own ways. But I would love for all the kids to be able to read it together.
So true. I have one of each. So I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
So Lydia, we have one question that we ask everyone. So you are no exception to the rule. How do you define success?
Define success by when I'm just feeling really happy and content with where I am in my life. You know, nothing feels dramatic. Nothing feels scary in a bad way. That's not to say that things won't come out of left field, as we all know, but you know, I feel right now I'm in a place of great success. I'm very happy with the way that my life is structured. I love the fact that I can be with my kids all the time. And then I can also do something I really love on stages and podcasts and all the things. So that to me feels like a really full cup, to use your term, just having all the things that really matter to me in a good place.
And we are so happy that you're in that place. What a beautiful spot to be. So where can our listeners find you and find your books?
Yes. So I'm on Instagram at Lydia Finette. I started it for my mom just so she would always know where I am. And it seems to have really taken on a life of its own. So if you need to find me, It's usually delayed by a bit, sometimes by 3 or 4 days, but you can catch up pretty quickly at Lydia Finet. And that's my LinkedIn handle. That's Facebook. And my books are available. I love independent bookstores. Diane's Books in Greenwich has been amazing. GF Ford in Sea Island has been amazing. And Garden District Bookstore down in New Orleans have all been such huge supporters. So buy there. They all have signed copies, I think, or on Amazon. And if you're not a reader, I also read the Audible books, which is super fun. And I have Claim Your Confidence podcast, which comes out every Tuesday with Rockefeller Center. So you can listen to that wherever you're listening to Full Plate, Full Cup. You can listen to this episode and then all the rest of those and then hop over to Claim Your Confidence.
I love that. Stack those episodes up. Lydia, thank you so much for joining us today. It was fantastic to talk to you. You are just such a powerhouse in so many ways. And, you know, one thing that I really just appreciate about you is that you not only claim your confidence, but you also claim who you are. You claim your success. You claim your joy. And isn't that just what we all wish for each other to do more of? So thank you for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. What a fun episode. Thank you guys for having me on.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Full Plate, Full Cup. If you found this episode helpful, please make sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with a friend.
To learn more about the Full Plate, Full Cup methodology or to work with us in a more personal way, find us on Instagram at Full Plate, Full Cup. That's at FullPlateFullCup or online at www.fullplatefullcup.com. www.fullplatefullcup.com.